The American Scene, a reassessment. Here's John Chancellor.
One of the most important things going on today is that a lot of Americans are searching for new values, new ways to relate their lives to the society they live in. And out of this search, hopefully, will come some new attitudes which will give identity and character to the 1970s. We've talked to a lot of people about this. Paul Duke in Washington put some of these questions to Ralph Nader.
Well, first, I think the lull is deceptive. I think the major conditions that have led to so much dissatisfaction still are with us, and in many respects will get worse. There's every indication, for example, that the environmental pollution problem will get worse, will lead to epidemics affecting our food and drinking water, as well as the general impact on people's health from the contamination of their immediate natural environment. In politics, for all the talk about reform of legislatures and campaign financing, there's been very little action. So what I think will occur in the next few years is an increasing focus on structural reform, like Common Cause is focusing on congressional institutions, and an increasing decentralization of citizenship activity throughout the country, led by students, retired people, and people who are willing to depart from their career roles for a tour of duty in this kind of work. I suspect that we'll have some serious air pollution inversions over cities, that increasingly our food will be seen to be contaminated by pollutants, and that we'll recognize just what an impact this is having on the nation's health. In a way, the 60s played out the public's expectation that institutions, private and public, in Washington and elsewhere, we're supposed to be responsive to the public interest. That can lead to despair and discouragement. On the other hand, it can lead to citizens organizing themselves and starting anew, right from the grassroots, to restructure and reshape and, if necessary, replace many of these institutions with something far more vibrant and reflective of the average citizen's concerns and values.
You can't investigate change in America without considering American students. They have seen to that. And so have we, since they are our children. But the children of today aren't the kids we knew in the 1960s when John Kennedy was in the White House. Those were the sunny days of idealism for American youth, the Mississippi Project, the Peace Corps. But then the war in Vietnam began to stain and discolor that idealism. And on top of that, the system itself in this country seemed corrupt and old-fashioned, and the idealism corroded into frustration and cynicism, and eventually into rioting and violence, and we were in a mess. But today, things are beginning to calm down. A man who has been watching all this is Dr. Calvin Lee of Boston University, author of a book called The Campus Scene, 1900 to 1970.
No one tolerates violence, and I think that a substantial majority of the student body on any campus would like to get away from the violent overtaking of buildings, and I think we will see less and less of this. I think, as a matter of fact, there's another kind of backlash happening right now, and that is I think there's a backlash of moderate students against the radicals. In terms of violence, I think that the issues are still there. I think that there's a real concern on the part of students about the interruption of their education, and they are responding more and more in that manner. If the war in Southeast Asia escalates, I can't predict that there won't be further takeovers, but I think that it won't take the proportions that it did in 1968 and 69. There's another ingredient here which is very interesting, and that is the economic recession has had a profound impact on the campuses. For the first time, many of these middle-class students are witnessing economic stress in their homes or in their neighbors' homes. And for these students, it may be the first time that they feel that, indeed, they may not have the opportunity to continue college if their parents can't continue with their income and so on. So they become more responsible, and that makes a real difference in the mood of a campus. I think the change in the draft laws has also had an effect, that fewer students, or male students anyway, are going to college just to stay out of the draft. More students are given the opportunity to come to college because they want to come to college.
Dr. Milton Eisenhower, who has thought long and carefully about this, offered his observations about students and their role in society.
At present, there is such strong opposition to the war on the part of young people. There is also a disappointment among the young that we haven't made greater progress in overcoming the problems of civil rights. And there's now an excitement about a very real problem, namely air and water pollution. And so the nihilist, the revolutionary, can get a better audience today than he could at almost any time in the past. We're going to have to learn to deal with this problem. And I think perhaps we are. You see the great difficulties that we were witnessing on our campuses from 1964 to 1969 have greatly diminished. I think that the reasonable students, and that's 95% of all of them, are realizing that to change the policies is a national problem, and therefore you have to work in the political arena and not take one's disappointment out on a university which had nothing to do with creating these difficulties in the first place and can't correct them.
One of the illustrations of change in the country can be found at the top in the Oval Office in the White House. There sits President Nixon, whose rhetoric about the young has changed markedly from his use of the word bums to describe student rioters to the genuine hand of friendship he extended to young people in a speech made last January at the University of Nebraska.
There can be no generation gap in America. The destiny of this nation is not divided into yours and ours. It is one destiny. We share it together. We are responsible for it together. And in the way we respond, history will judge us together. I believe one of America's most priceless assets is the idealism which motivates the young people of America. My generation has invested all that it has, not only its love, but its hope and its faith in yours. And so let us forge an alliance of the generations. Let us work together to seek out those ways by which the commitment and the compassion of one generation can be linked to the will and the experience of another, so that together we can serve America better, and America can better serve mankind. Our priorities are really the same. Together we can achieve them.
In the same speech, President Nixon proposed a consolidation of such groups as the Peace Corps into one unified organization to broaden opportunity for young people who desire to serve the nation. The head of the Peace Corps, Joseph Blatchford, would head the new organization. Here are some of Mr. Blatchford's thoughts.
The individual young person now is searching more for a personal expression, a personal way in which he can make a contribution. And one of the problems is that he's grown up to think that the BA degree or the MA degree is the end-all, and that it's a guarantee of a job and security for life. And for the first time in our history, we're learning it isn't, and he can't get a job. And he lacks a certain sense of goals and purpose. You know, the automatic thing of going on to the BA and the MA and the PhD is not really noteworthy anymore when you have so many unemployed physicists. So the young person today is searching more for a skill, and he responds very well to the Peace Corps' idea that we'll take a man with a general background, a liberal arts background, and train him in simple skills of farming or mechanics or something, and then he can transfer that on a personal, individual basis to poor farmers and help them achieve a better life. And that, I think, is what is the wave of the future. I think people highly charged with liberal educations are going to want to find ways to make a personal contribution to people and be satisfied with that, and abandon more of the mass movements and the rhetoric of politics.
Another sign of the new mood can be found in the person and writings of Sam Brown, one of the organizers of the Vietnam Moratorium, a tireless and skilled organizer in the anti-war movement. Brown has drawn back from the movement, what there is of it, because he too has recognized a new mood.
In some ways, the major thrust of the peace movement has really been won with the American people. Senator Church pointed out that most people today accept the notion, which the peace movement was in a minority in advocating only 3 or 4 years ago, that the United States should not be involved in Vietnam, that the troops should come home from there. And as a consequence, it's a very difficult proposition now to organize around that question. What instead has to be done is the much more difficult educational task of making it clear that that's not what Richard Nixon is doing. For so long as people believe that he is doing that which the peace movement has advocated for years, it's impossible to get any sentiment up among people to say the president has to do more. So what's necessary now is to do that very hard educational job that was done initially on the war 5 or 6 years ago through the teach-ins of going back and saying, but this policy is not one which gets us out of Vietnam, but one which widens the war and which bogs us down there virtually eternally. And that's a difficult task. And I think the way that it has to be carried out is not through the kind of mass public activity that we've seen in the past, but rather through, as I say, those more limited and more difficult educational kinds of things, such as teach-ins, canvassing projects, petition, which require someone really to think before they act rather than simply acting. Somehow or another, there isn't the same level of vindictiveness and venom about Richard Nixon that there was about Lyndon Johnson for reasons of, I suppose, in part at least personality and accent, but also because of style. He was so flamboyant about what he did, it was easy to work up a pretty substantial sentiment in the country about Lyndon Johnson, where Richard Nixon is in many ways, other than the San Jose incident, not that kind of person. And for that reason, it's much quieter kind of disagreement. I think there's very little can be done in the short run about changing presidents, and it makes very little sense simply to make noise in order to make noise. There has to be a political consequence of that, and right now there is no channel open, at least for another 18 months. Demonstrations are an answer at times, and I thought there was a time when they were important and valuable. As I say, I think right now the more important task to be done is that quieter one of education, and you don't do that by standing in the street and proclaiming what you believe. You do it instead by the kind of quiet contact and personal conversation to convince people. So that demonstration is not an eternally outworn tactic, but at the same time it's not an eternally applicable tactic, and I think right now is a time when it's not particularly applicable. That better are the quieter ways of reaching new constituencies. Richard Nixon, after all, knows that a substantial portion of the people in the country are opposed to the war in Vietnam, that he's not going to win those of us who are opposed. The question is whether we can take constituents away from him. And I don't believe that you steal his Middle America constituency out from underneath him by demonstrating. I believe that you take that constituency away from him by out-organizing him. And you don't organize that at a national level. You organize it at local levels. And you just take it away from him.
One of the curiosities of the age is that the word revolution and the slogan power to the people are now being used by the gray-flanneled men of the Nixon administration. They still worry about the war, mainly in terms of getting out, but the main White House emphasis these days is on domestic affairs, welfare, health, and what Mr. Nixon calls his plan for a new American revolution, revenue sharing. Revenue sharing would give power to the people, it is said, because it would give money to the states and the cities. One of the places where the money is desperately needed is in the cities. Here is Boston's Mayor Kevin White on revenue sharing.
I think revenue sharing is an idea whose time has come. Whether that time is today or tomorrow, next month or this year, is hard to say. There are political ramifications. There is blocks in Washington with a great deal of power who want all the money to be earmarked to specific projects, who are vehemently against the concept of letting local communities decide how federal tax dollars should be spent. Their influence is considerable. So is the president's. The battle will be titanic. I think that this is probably the biggest single domestic conflict that will occur in Congress for at least the next 5 years. Whether it will be one this year or next, I am not sure, but I am confident that it will be one in time. But the cities don't have much time.
White says that one of the most important things in revenue sharing is the time element.
It's a long process of decay. 100 years we've paid little attention to the American city, and I would agree that two more isn't going to make much difference. But there comes a point in which the reversal process, the recovery process, like with a patient, reaches a point of which you cannot revive them. And that's the critical junction. Not that the cities will die in the sense of disappearing tomorrow, but you will reach a point where they are not salvageable. The case becomes terminable. And in my opinion, the American city is in that fine line and gray area. And we're behind. We're 10 years behind now in our responses. Can we wait another 2, another 3, another 5? That's a judgment that anyone can make and see from a different viewpoint. But cities are the civilization as we know it, and it's a question of whether we have the willpower to save our own civilization.
This far in our reconnaissance of the new American landscape, we have learned that there is, in fact, a new mood among young people and an effort on the part of the president to make the institutions which serve us more responsive to our needs. But what about the blacks? The figures are mixed. Some blacks are beginning to make it economically, believe it or not, but many are still locked in cages of frightful poverty and unemployment, supported by the thin and demeaning gruel of a detested welfare system. Nevertheless, there are changes here to be perceived as well. An example is a fellow named Jimmy Carter, who took office as governor of Georgia a while back and made an astounding statement. The day of segregation in the South, he said, is over. And Jimmy Carter doesn't think of himself as a maverick. He says he's got the support of the people.
Well, I didn't have the backing of the economic and social and the political power structure. I had to go directly to the people. I spent most of my time campaigning in factory shift lines and shopping centers and among the people themselves. My wife and I personally visited more than 700,000 Georgians. And we talked to them and we listened. I think because of this, visiting all of Georgia's 159 counties, that when I did speak, toward the end of the campaign at least, and I think now, that I could very accurately predict the effect of what I had to say on the different groups in Georgia. I think I understand our people. And I think it's also important to point out that in South Carolina with John West and in Florida with Reuben Askew, in North Carolina with Bob Scott, that we are not leaders who are trying to inspire our people to change their ways. We are leaders elected in a fair, hard-fought campaign in each instance within the last year or so, who I think accurately represent the majority of our people.
One of the great experts on our country is the citizen of another, a Swedish sociologist who has spent his life finding out how we live and where we are going. He has been consistently accurate in his scholarship and correct in his predictions, and he was back here in the American South only last year. He is, of course, Gunnar Myrdal, and we sent our Stockholm correspondent, Alan Simon, to ask Myrdal some questions.
If you take it as a whole, I think that particularly in the South, let's keep to the South, that the white Americans there in the South are getting more and more accustomed to the fact that there is going to be a change in status upwards of Negroes. They are taking it. And the funny thing, as I observed, was that they are almost proud of it. Many people, I mean, who would be against desegregation of schools, when they are desegregated, they would tell me as a foreigner, look here what we have done in the South, you know. When fait accompli, when something is gained in the South, it sticks there because the attitudes are adjusting. I do believe that that is what's happening. If it was only the South in America, I would not be very pessimistic about the racial crisis in America.
Governor Jimmy Carter of Georgia agrees with Myrdal, and Carter says that from now on it won't be smart politics for a Georgia politician to run a campaign based on keeping the blacks in their place.
Well, I think we have accurately recognized that to eliminate discrimination in hiring practices and utilization of public facilities and so forth relieves the decision maker in the South, whether he be a business leader or a political leader, of an albatross that's been around our neck for a long time. Formerly, several years back, racial considerations were overwhelming in almost any decision made. Also, we recognize that it's of economic benefit to us to have full hiring practices, not to discriminate against any person because he's black or because of other reasons. We also have relatively high employment in our region. We have a lot to offer industry. And in spite of the fact that nationwide the unemployment rate is maybe 6% or more, in Georgia it's still 3% or less. So we need active and aggressive hiring. And so we have, for this reason, ceased to discriminate against Negroes because of their race. If they're qualified to work, we hire them. If they're not qualified, we have vocational technical schools to teach them how to hold a job that that's available for them. Also, of course, we are complying with the federal laws. It's obvious to me that as long as the federal directives, which changed racial attitudes in the South, came from governmental agencies like HEW as guidelines, that it was not possible politically for local leaders to comply. But as soon as the directive shifted, which occurred in the last few years, to the federal courts, the overwhelming desire of Georgians to comply with the law prevailed, and Georgians made a simple decision. We will obey the law even if we do it reluctantly and even if we don't like to. Now we've made that decision. We face the future with a new freedom to make our own decisions based on merits of a case and not on race. We don't want to go back and face this traumatic decision again. So I'd say law, economics, basic justice have proven so far to be the factors that have changed the South in the last few years.
One of the most astute and most articulate Negro spokesmen is the young congressman from Georgia, Julian Bond.
You see growing very slowly in black communities around the country increased interest in holding on to what we already have, and that is to say that people say that Harlem, for example, is not the most pleasant place in the world in which to live. But since black people do live there, and in Bedford-Stuyvesant, the south side of Chicago, and the south side of Atlanta, in all of the ghettos and slums and different parts of the country, that since we must live in these areas, let's make them secure. Let's make them attractive to us. Let's ensure that we control the businesses in that community. Let's make sure that we control the politics in that community. If we must live in these parts of the city and we must live in overcrowded circumstances, let's use that to our own advantage. And I think you can see that happening in city after city. Second, I think, is that more and more you see people in the black community who a few years ago were scornful of politics, seeing it as one of several ways of solving problems. And you see in the black community a general consensus which says that politics is far from perfect. Politics will not solve all our problems, but it will solve some of them. And it solves one crucial problem, which is control. Who controls? Who controls your life? Who controls your job? Who controls the police? Who controls the schools? Who controls whether or not your garbage is picked up on time? Who controls whether policemen are courteous and kindly to you, or whether they're abusive and evil? All of those things are key to the lives of any group of people, regardless of their race or economic status. And I think black people are beginning to see in larger and larger numbers that it's important for us to have something to say about it.
So there are some small hopeful signs, although they are by no means apparent to the millions of American blacks who still are not given a decent chance at least to start life equal with their fellow men. And even in the wreckage of our cities, in the foul air and the dirty water, other signs of hopeful change are being observed by some men and women. As far as the future is concerned, some of the experts say you can toss a coin. One way is a new wave of violence, the fire next time. The other way is a reawakening of a spirit of mutuality and pride and determination to fix things up which are wrong. But either way, we are Americans, and we must always acknowledge that we carry a little strain of violence in our blood. One man who knows more about this strain of violence than he probably wanted to know is Dr. Milton Eisenhower, who chaired the President's Commission on Violence.
We do seem to have a new kind of violence in this country. We have some people we're actively advocating revolution, which I think is relatively new in America. Where do you think this will lead to? Do you think this is a self-defeating thing?
First, let me say that there are nihilists, there are revolutionaries, most of them young, many of them in our colleges and universities. But it's terribly important that the American people understand that they constitute a very small minority. They make a lot of noise, and I may say the mass media give them a great exposure to the American people, but they can't be more than 1, 2, or 3% of the total. Yes, this is something new.
How do you answer the argument that we engage in violence in Vietnam, so violence is warranted here in America, and those who argue that the system is so rotten and has such basic defects that the system itself is not worth preserving, and hence you need a revolution in this country to purify the government?
Well, I think that's a terribly specious argument. If we lived in a dictatorship, and the dictatorship had proclaimed and carried on the war, and therefore citizens could do little, if anything, about it, one could well argue that in these circumstances, revolution, internal revolution, would be the corrective measure to take. But once the people themselves have taken possession of the basic social power, which is the situation in our free democratic society, and we exercise this power through a representative form of government, then the only reasonable way to get action is to work through these political procedures. All other methods are illegitimate and are self-defeating. Margaret Chase Smith made a speech in the Senate that was worth the attention of the American people, in which she said that if the left-wing extremists, who are causing a good share of the trouble, don't look out, they are going to drive America to the right. The danger in America is not in going far to the left. The danger is going too far to the right.
Do you feel that the recommendations of your commission have been largely ignored, or do you feel they've been taken to heart?
When we submitted our recommendations to the president, I fully anticipated that there would not be a serious implementation so long as the Vietnam War is on, because the fiscal situation of our government, I recognize, is a precarious one. So I didn't expect the millennium to happen overnight. Now, I'm not discouraged, because a number of national organizations, such as the Urban Coalition, the American Jewish Committee, the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, have adopted our report and are using it throughout the nation in carrying on educational programs.
It is pretty much generally agreed that many of the agonies of the late 1960s were related to the failure of our institutions to respond to the needs of the people. This surely led us to the bloody Watts riots. It had a lot to do with the anti-war movement. It was at the root of student unrest, and it still is. So it is possible to argue that the central question of our national life involves the machinery we have set up to operate our nation, the courts, the cops, the Congress, City Hall, the State House. And questions are being asked about these institutions now by everyone from the president down to the most ragged radical. I have been asking questions about this, put to an articulate senator from Tennessee named Howard Baker. One particular question: are we being manipulated by a system which isn't working?
Ever since the Depression, we've adopted an attitude of cynicism toward government and its ability to function that's been predictably passed on to our children and our children's children. So let's those of us who have children now that are about to enter the realm of adulthood take our fair share for the blame. Now, this traces back to something that's very basic, to the fact that most of the needs of civilization are little needs. To see that the garbage is collected, to see that the house is warm, that there's food in the larder, that the children have an opportunity to grow up without undue distress, that we have an opportunity to educate them and send them on their way without undue guilt, and that all these things occur within the framework of our own ability to maintain our personal image. Those things were brought into challenge during the Great Depression. They were brought into challenge again and probably magnified by World War II. And then the real cynicism set in with the Korean War and with the Cold War in Europe and with Vietnam. And to try to summarize this plaintive cry, the people of the United States in particular, and of the world to some extent, decided that we couldn't be brave and keep a stiff upper lip forever. And it's human nature to blame it on the closest institution at hand, and that's the government. So you see, after those wanderings, I suggest that the government isn't really as bad as a lot of people think, and the delivery system isn't as defective. As a matter of fact, the institutions are responsive, but you see, they're responding to cynicism and an attitude that we've done our very best for God and country maybe too long. So there has to be a freshness of spirit and a new aspiration. It was supplied temporarily with a space program, but that soon ran its course. It is now served in the younger generation by a spirit of rebellion, absolute change for the sake of change. I sense that it's beginning to attenuate a little, and there will be a new national objective. That's what will change, and that's what will reinvigorate our confidence in our governing institutions.
What you're really saying, Senator, is that we need idealism to return to us as a quality we all share commonly. You sound like a new frontier searcher.
Well, I wouldn't have chosen exactly those terms, but I plead guilty to the allegation in substance. I am, because I believe the human spirit thrives on reaching out for new things. And I believe the great challenge of mankind is just before us, just now beginning to emerge. And I think that's to improve by a quantum jump the quality of life on this planet. To eliminate poverty, to eliminate discrimination, to create a better life. That may be the next best challenge, and if it is, it'll take some wrenching changes to bring our governing institutions into accord with that ambition, but we'll do it.
How close do you think we are, Senator, when you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and things look very gloomy about the future of the cities, for example, about how the society knits together? How close do you suppose we are, if these things don't work, to some sort of serious breakdown?
Very close. I think we've skated on the edge of disaster for a number of years now. And if you'll let me use another poetic description, I think trying to solve the problems of our cities with the techniques we know today, such as slum clearance, urban renewal, and the like, good as they are, but the trying to use the techniques we know today is roughly the equivalent to trying to print the daily output of the New York Times on the Gutenberg press.
A Frenchman, Jean-François Revel, has written a book soon to be published in this country under the title The New American Revolution. He argues that the United States will generate a new approach to the problems of the 20th century and will foster what he calls a worldwide revolutionary march onto a higher plane of living. He believes the United States has, as no other country has, assimilated the positive aspects of such previous upheavals as the Industrial Revolution. And he argues that the United States already has embarked on solving the problems of the day, such as the environment and poverty. He indicates the country's sense of concern about itself, as it is just the forerunner to an eventual solution of the problems. In Paris, Mr. Revel was interviewed by George V. Lewis.
Monsieur Revel, you have written a book that is remarkable, I think, for two reasons. It's about the condition of American society, and it is also not an anti-American book, which these days is somewhat refreshing coming from a European writer. How do you define this revolution, as you put it?
In America has begun first a revolution which takes for granted the civil rights, for instance. Of course, the American citizen has also to fight for civil rights all the time. But, I mean, it's more or less a fact that what I call the 18th century revolution, which took place in Western Europe and America, has been assimilated. And second, the great industrial revolution led to the necessity of rethinking society. And you have many American sociologists now who are thinking about a new type of society. And which is more important, you have a very deep feeling, a very deep need in the youth, for instance. But I think that everybody, even what you call the silent majority, feels that something has to be done about a new, for instance, organization of the technological society. America has been confronted, is the first country to have been confronted to the new problems of the scientific technological society, the problems of urbanization, and also the problem of a new type of culture. American has to solve the problem of environment and was the first country to have a very acute consciousness of the problem of ecology. America has to solve the problem of the cities. America has world responsibilities, like England in the 19th century, but with a much deeper consciousness of what those responsibilities mean and of what they lead to. So, I mean, the problems which all other countries, without exception, will meet one day or another, America has met.
Well, maybe so, maybe not. Nevertheless, it is true that life in this country is lived just a bit ahead of life in other parts of the world. Other countries just now are waking up to the problems of pollution, overcrowding, alienation. We didn't export those problems. We just lived through them before anybody else. And perhaps we are learning some dim and early lessons about bringing change to our outmoded institutions. One man who is deeply involved in this is John Gardner, the scholar who once served as Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, and who now runs a brand new outfit called Common Cause. Common Cause is a citizens' lobby with over 100,000 new members, and its purpose is to organize its members to work for specific changes. So far, the short history of Common Cause is a mixed record, but Gardner thinks he may have found the way.
I think there is no question that a lot of people in this country are beginning to see that they can have an impact, and I think they're beginning to see that they won't have that impact unless they repair the public process in this country, which is very badly decayed. And I'm talking about our city councils, state legislatures, the Congress of the United States, all the instruments of the people. There are a lot of other ways to get things done, but the only way the people can get things done is through the instruments of self-government, and they've neglected them.
Do you suppose there was a period, or there is an inevitable period, in the development of any big society like ours, where the government, because of its, let's say, federal necessities, gets out of hand? It no longer becomes our government.
I think this is not really something you can examine historically. I think it's a function of modern civilization, that vastness and complexity and technology have just swept over us. And I have to say, we let them sweep over us. We let it happen. We didn't pay much attention. And now we're going to have to get back in command of these huge institutions. And I mean both governmental and private. The people have to find some way of calling to account the institutions that dominate their lives.
Mr. Gardner, do you see a comparable desire on the part of the institutions themselves, actually the people in them, for reform?
No. But I don't hold that against the institutions. I think that every institution since the beginning of time ended up serving itself and serving insiders, and this is in the nature of human institutions, and human institutions will never reform themselves. I don't care whether you're talking about Harvard University or the U.S. Navy.
or GM or HEW. It's just not in the nature of an institution to do that. It does it when somebody outside gives it a heck of a jolt. Now, in the business world, that jolt often comes from the competition. And throughout history, jolts have come from wars and invasions and catastrophes. And we just have to learn how to administer that jolt through the force of public opinion and public action to get institutions to move.
So to sum up, you see some change and some hope.
Oh, yes. But I see a very hard road ahead. I believe in my heart that we can make it. But to make it, we're going to be honest about our problems. We're going to have some courage, have to have some courage, and it may be painful. The president in his State of the Union address talked about the Second American Revolution, but essentially he talked about a revolution without any pain for anybody. Nobody's going to get hurt. Nobody's going to have to give up anything. And I believe a lot of us are going to have to give up some of our special privileges and so forth. We may have to pay some more taxes. Some of the industries may have to spend more money on pollution control and so on. You can't move ahead without some strain and stress for somebody.
We are coming now toward the end of this program, and we think we ought to end it with the words of some of the people we talked with on this assignment. Here are two Americans, two Europeans. Milton Eisenhower.
I have considerable faith in this country and in the democratic process. I live with the faith that if the human mind is just exposed to all the facts, circumstances, and ideas, both good and bad, that eventually lies will die of their own poison and that truth will prevail and that the American people will stand for what is right. Yes, of course I have hope. I'm sure we'll solve the problem.
Jean-François Revel of Paris.
It's the first time in history that I see the most powerful country in the world at a specific moment, criticize itself from the inside on such a scale. Because everybody was against France during the Algerian War, except Frenchmen. Everybody was against England during the Boer War, except Englishmen. Even if American now liberal and radicals are very pessimistic and bitter about fact that the Vietnamese war does not end, it seems, without solution, and it begins again with a new episode every 6 months. From the outside, I mean, the situation, the way the Americans live that, what they do, the fact that there is a Khaled trial, that there will be a Medina trial, are new facts. You have never seen that in Germany or France or England or Rome, you see. And, I mean, in the long run, for the building of the future civilization, that's an important thing.
Gunnar Myrdal of Stockholm.
The good thing about America, as I see it, is that I know no people in the world who can change so rapidly and so fundamentally as the Americans. I believe it's a sort of, what shall I say, heritage from Puritan religion. They have conversions. I mean, just to take one example, when the war started last time, America went in as isolationists in extreme, and they went out of it, as I look upon it, as interventionists in extreme. There you saw this tremendous change, and I still believe that there will be more again when we are away from this horrible Vietnam War, that again there will be a fundamental change, and that America will stand up for its ideals. That's what I'm hoping for.
Ralph Nader.
This is the big experiment of the 70s, as I see it. You can see it in the student groups forming. You can see it in the public interest lawyers that are developing around the country, the movement among the young physicians, the movement among student groups to begin establishing their own action arms, lawyers and scientists and ecologists representing their needs, and a greater movement of self-reliance in our slums toward community action groups. This is the decade of experimentation in solid full-time citizen action.
That's our program. The message of it is perhaps more comforting than we thought when we began it. Have hope, don't emigrate, work for change, keep listening.